One result of the Occupy Spring was the resurgence of a radical queer form of activism here in the Bay. Today, the gay and lesbian community, especially the gay male community, is seen as one of San Francisco's most powerful political minorities. But in 1988, that was not the case. Not only was it still legal under California law to discriminate against LGBT people in housing, employment, and education, but the gay community was being ravaged by a deadly and virulent disease which had recently been named AIDS. In response to this mortal threat, an important social movement evolved which would change not only the way that we treat AIDS, but our understanding of the relationship between social policy and disease, science, and, quote, natural disasters. This movement grew from many threads in the lesbian and gay communities at that time, but it came together under the banner of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the founding of ACT UP New York. The name was first used here in the Bay Area about a year later. Coming up tomorrow at the San Francisco International LGBT Film Festival is a film called United in Anger, which documents the birth and growth of this grassroots movement from the perspective of those who made it happen. Joining me now to talk about this film is one of the producers, Sarah Schulman. Sarah is the author of 17 books, most recently The Gentrification of the Mind, Witness to a Lost Imagination. She is co-founder of the ACT UP Oral History Project and Mix NY LGBT Experimental Film and Video Festival, and a distinguished professor of the humanities at the City University of New York. In a little while, we'll also be joined by Sid Nova, an HIV prevention worker and one of the younger activists who are trying to revive ACT UP San Francisco. Sarah, congratulations on this inspiring film.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining me.
Sure.
You're primarily known as an author and activist, so how did you come to make a film about ACT UP?
Well, Jim Hubbard, who is my collaborator on the film, we've been collaborators for 25 years. We founded the Mix Festival, which is now having its 25th anniversary, and so we've been working together in the realm of film for a very long time. Then in 2001, we realized that ACT UP had been completely forgotten. We had both been in ACT UP. And that, in fact, the AIDS activist movement had been forgotten. And so we started the ACT UP Oral History Project. And basically, just the two of us, we began systematically interviewing surviving members of ACT UP New York and posting the interviews on our website, which is actuporalhistory.org. And to date, 10 years later, we've interviewed 134 people. The full transcripts of each interview are available for free on the website, and 90,000 people have downloaded those transcripts. You can also watch 5 minutes of each person's interview. Now, in the course of doing this, Jim, who's a film preservationist, also was involved with preserving over 1,000 hours of archival footage from the ACT UP era. And, of course, this is very interesting footage because video was pretty much invented in the middle of ACT UP. So ACT UP sort of invented video activism. And a lot of the footage that we got were in outmoded forms, you know, because at the beginning people were shooting in film. And there was no mechanism for recording off a television set. They would aim their 16-millimeter cameras at a TV set and actually film the broadcast. Then, you know, there were these huge beta video decks where you had to have one person carry the deck and the other person had to carry the boom microphone. And then the camcorder was invented. And that's when ACT UP started to have video activist collectives like Testing the Limits and Diva TV, who would shoot their own footage and then bring it to the television stations, as well as doing their own newsreel type of broadcasts on cable and in community venues like Mix Festival, for example. So we had all of this footage, and Jim is a filmmaker, and he decided that he would make a documentary film. So you could say that this film took 10 years to make.
And even though the film is completed, you're continuing to do interviews for the Oral History Project?
Yes, we are. We want to interview everyone who wants to be interviewed. And it's a long process. I mean, there's just two of us, and sometimes people have to wait 5 years to get interviewed. But systematically, we do get to everybody.
Wow, it seems like you could recruit co-collaborators from
not
other
really
areas.
You know, it's very
not
interesting
so
because, well, one thing is we have not hit a critical mass of information even in 10 years. So with every interview, we're expanding our knowledge base. And we're constantly reconceptualizing ACT UP. I mean, Jim and I now have more cumulative information about ACT UP than anybody. We really see the big picture, which is always expanding. And if you had, you know, people asking pre-created questions in some kind of robotic manner like they do with some of the Holocaust memorial projects, you just wouldn't get that kind of constant expansion into new areas. You know, I don't understand how somebody who wasn't part of something can actually conduct oral histories, to tell you the truth, because my personal relationships with the people I'm interviewing has really been a huge part of, you know, the information gathering. We knew that ACT UP was very complex, and because it was the last successful social movement in America, it's very important to understand why it was successful to the extent that it was. I mean, there's a temptation to tell the story of, you know, the white men who saved the world, right? This handful of white gay males who fought their way into the system and forced pharmaceutical companies to do the research. But that's not actually what ACT UP was, nor how things happened. It was a very, very diverse organization. It had all kinds of leadership in all kinds of arenas. I mean, ACT UP spent 4 years forcing the Center for Disease Control to change its definition of AIDS so that women with AIDS could get benefits and get treatment. And we have really incredible footage from that, those campaigns, where women of color who were in leadership of the Women with AIDS Empowerment Movement, all of whom are now dead. And you see them demonstrating, speaking. You see them out in the rain in front of the CDC offices, getting arrested, literally kicking and screaming, pulled into police cars. And these are people whose names no one knew except for the people who knew them and remembered. So, you know, we're really telling a very complex story. And, of course, you know, truthfully, change doesn't happen easily. Change happens in complicated ways. It's worth understanding. I think there's a lot of people today who would love to have enormous changes, you know, enormous paradigm shifts at the level of what ACT UP achieved, but they don't know how to do it. And we really have constructed this film in such a way that you can understand how to build a movement that will be effective.
Well, what's the answer to that then?
One is, well, I mean, let me start with one thing. I mean, and this is interesting that ACT UP, without knowing it, adapted pretty much the same strategy that Martin Luther King used. But it was, they were unaware that they were doing that. And then when I was reading his letter from Birmingham jail, he laid it out, and I was like, wow, that's what ACT UP did. Basically, you first educate yourself so that you are the expert on your issue. Then you conceptualize a solution that is winnable, doable, and reasonable. You then propose it clearly to the powers that be who have the opportunity to put it to effect. When they refuse, you do direct action, and you communicate with the public through the media to force them to respond to your demands. Another factor is that you have to have a multiplicity of activity going on at the same time. ACT UP was not a consensus-based organization. If you wanted to do something and I didn't want to do it, I didn't have to do it, but I wouldn't stop you from doing it. People were allowed to do the things they needed to do with other people who agreed with them, and these formations were called affinity groups, simultaneously with other people in ACT UP doing other things that perhaps the first group of people would not feel comfortable doing. And in this way, there was so much activity simultaneously in so many different realms that it created a critical mass.
Well, this seems like a good place to bring in Sid Nova, who joins me now in studio. Sid wrote about this film, United in Anger, in last week's Bay Area Reporter. And Sid, you wrote, "This is the story my generation has been waiting to see." What did you mean by that statement?
So as someone who is part of many communities that are strongly affected by HIV, trans people, queer people, sex workers, we are seeing kind of how HIV is ravaging our community in a different way than is commonly thought of in a wider sense. I think that people have this idea of like AIDS as something that is either in the past or something that is, you know, a controlled, you know, disease. As I was told in an HIV prevention training, tell people that it's like having diabetes. And for some people, that is true, that is reality. It is a really different situation, scenario than what was happening in the 80s when, you know, they, as I think Vito Russo said, I feel like I'm in a battle where people are dying all around me, but no one is seeing it except for the people who are part of that scenario. But for me, I still know people who die of AIDS, and I work at a clinic with a lot of homeless folks, and HIV is still affecting my communities in a really strong way, but the response to it, a grassroots response to it, is not there. So that's why depictions such as United in Anger about a community-driven response to a crisis that for me and my communities is still happening is something that feels incredibly important.
Can you just talk a little about your own history and how you learned about AIDS and HIV?
I became a HIV outreach worker when I was 17 in northern New Mexico because it was the only way that I could find gay community. I was like, I was definitely closeted at that time. And there was also just not a lot of queer people around. And so as I grew up, a threat that my parents kind of held for me around being queer was like, oh, you'll get AIDS and die. So that was obviously a really horrible thing to hear. But the offside of that was I was like, oh, well, if like gay people get AIDS, then I can go to an AIDS service organization and find gay people. So that's how I kind of got into HIV prevention. And then later in my life as a sex worker and someone who was around a lot of queer and trans people, it got a lot more personalized by people being HIV positive around me. And being around that, but also within my generation, seeing that people didn't really know how to engage with that, people didn't know how to have conversations about that, people didn't know how to do support work anymore.
Well, Sarah Schulman, that leads into something I wanted to ask you about. You called ACT UP the last successful social movement in this country. ACT UP's tagline was, "We are a diverse group of individuals united in anger and committed to direct action to bring an end to the AIDS crisis." But clearly, as Sid has been saying, we did not succeed in ending the AIDS crisis.
No, but we created a paradigm shift in many, many arenas. I can tell you what ACT UP did and what ACT UP did not. But one thing is that when the AIDS crisis began in 1981, well, first of all, people with AIDS had absolutely no protections. They could be evicted from their jobs. They could be kicked out of their homes. They could be denied treatment. There was no treatment. And, of course, for the people who were gay, which was a large part of that population at that time, we still had sodomy laws in the United States. So basically you had a despised community with no rights who were facing a terminal disease and had been abandoned by their government and their families. Now that's where we started in 1981. The profound transformation in how people with AIDS are treated and viewed in the United States, considering the short amount of time from 1981 to now, it's truly phenomenal. It does not mean that there's not enormous problems going on, and I can tell you what they are. Okay, but one of the successes was forcing the government and private industry to do the research that was necessary to produce medications that can help people live longer and, in some cases, live full lives. That's quite amazing when you think that in 1981 no one knew what caused AIDS and no one was doing research on it. Now, the obstacle is that in the U.S., because we don't have a sane healthcare system, these medications are not equally available to everyone who needs them. And certainly globally, global pharma has completely blockaded the necessary drugs from going to countries that can't afford their bill. And these are problems of political will. Now, it also really pushed forward the visibility of gay people in the United States and around the world. Before AIDS, many people pretended that gay people did not exist. It was easy to do that, and now it would be impossible. That's just a tremendous paradigm shift, and of course it has affected the way queer people see themselves. And that's because a huge counterculture was created around this movement. So, you know, it's had enormous successes and it has very significant obstacles.
So why do you think, given that it has been virtually forgotten by the mainstream media and consequently by the U.S. public?
Because America likes to naturalize political events. So instead of saying thousands of people fought until their deaths to force this country to change against its will, which is the actual truth, the way that we assimilate the efforts of political movements is to say that to have a false progress narrative, that over time things get better, which is not true. Things do not get better over time. Things change because activists force them to change. And that's the kind of story that America doesn't tell. So that's why initially it was forgotten, and I think this is why now it's being remembered again. I mean, two people can make a big difference. Cultural activism is a very interesting activity. I mean, even with the Mix Festival, we started a queer experimental film festival in 1986, and now there's people showing in that festival who weren't born when we started. And one of the things we've learned is that when you create a venue, you create artists, because people grow up seeing that there's a place to show this work, and it helps them decide to make it.
I know that here in San Francisco, at least, there were some pretty bitter fights within ACT UP, and some of them were about sexism in the group. And specifically, the fact that as lesbians, those of us who had chosen to participate in many ways did it for very different reasons than a lot of the gay men in the group. We were affected by AIDS, of course, but we were affected by it mainly because of our relationship with gay men and because of our relationship with our communities at large. And at the same time, many of us were active in the women's movement. We were active in lesbian-only movements. And in many ways, those movements really suffered for the fact that we were putting most of our energy into fighting AIDS
with that.
At that time.
I think that ACT UP achieved more for women with AIDS than any other entity did or could have.
So did you experience any sexism or any resistance to your participation as a lesbian in ACT UP in New York?
Well, those are two separate things. I mean, they needed us desperately because we had come out of very active movements and knew how to do things. And a lot of these guys had never done anything before. So, I mean, in our interviews, for example, we interviewed Marion Bonsoff, who had been very active in the feminist women's health clinic scene in Florida. And she literally sat down with ACT UP and did an educational about being an activist patient, which was an unknown concept to a lot of the men. So, you know, she literally brought the feminist politics of healthcare to ACT UP. Then you have another one we interviewed is Amy Bauer, who had come out of the Women's Peace Movement, Women's Pentagon Action, and pacifism. And she's the person that many, many people credit with creating the style of nonviolence that was at the base of our direct actions. So you can see she's coming directly from the women's movement. I mean, myself, Maxine Wolf, I mean, there were plenty of people who had come out of the women's movement with great skills that really transformed ACT UP. Now, that's different than sexism. You know, most men are pretty much sexist on some kind of regular schedule. But one of the interesting things about ACT UP was that it never got fixated on trying to change individuals. And I think that was politically very astute, because you could spend your whole life trying to change one person and destroy your movements in the process.
So as I mentioned in my intro, there's a group of people coming mainly out of Occupy San Francisco who are trying to resuscitate ACT UP San Francisco. Sarah, how do you feel about that?
You know, it's interesting because the Occupy movement represents a certain kind of tradition in American politics, which is we saw it with utopian socialism in the 1840s, with the anarchists in the 1920s, the hippie movement in the 1960s. It's a movement that's looking for total transformation. ACT UP was a reform movement. And some of the problems that people with AIDS are facing now have to do with, you know, the fact that it was a reform movement on capitalism, and it's capitalism that is continuing to obstruct people with AIDS. So these kinds of movements, utopian movements versus reform movements, they've always had really interesting dynamics, and I think we've all been most successful when they kind of work together. You know, for example, during the Vietnam War. Now, the question about, you know, it's interesting that someone from Occupy would go towards a more demand-oriented trajectory like ACT UP. And I'm really looking forward to see what they do.
Well, Sid, you are one of those folks, so what are you planning to do?
Some of the things we're planning, we're going to do a banner draw at Pink Saturday. And then we are organizing with Occupride, which is a group of people who were kind of in the Occupy movement who, upon becoming aware of that to be in Pride, you have to pay to march in the Pride, which is just so ridiculous to me. It's my understanding of Pride is like that is like people coming together to march and like show solidarity. That is like a parade of Wells Fargo's floats, you know, which uphold the prison industrial complex, which, you know, is one of the major reasons that HIV is spread through, you know, people of color communities. Bank of America is going to, you know, have a float. Clear Channel Radio, that all of these things are incorporated into our festival and celebration of ourselves, but yet, you know, individuals are not allowed to just walk in that themselves is really atrocious. So there are a bunch of people who are planning to disrupt that.
So it sounds like you all are definitely taking the position that I always had and the parts of the AIDS movement that I was part of. You know, we're always very clear that we weren't only trying to get better AIDS drugs and more access to them. But, I mean, we were working on immigration issues. We were working on prison issues. We were anti-war. And nowadays, most activism tends to be more narrowly focused. And a lot of people argue that you can't be effective if you take on too many issues.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you and the other people who are reviving ACT UP here don't feel that way, but what do you think about that?
There's definitely a couple of issues that we are centering on. So one of those is on prizes, not patents. So Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, proposed a bill to the Senate, which is about awarding cash prizes for HIV treatment, vaccines, you know, a cure. God, imagine, instead of patents. So, you know, we're living in the system where HIV meds can be anywhere from like $25 to $75 a day. And that is prohibitively expensive for people. And we're also living in a time where, you know, we're in a recession where health budget cuts get cut. So, you know, there's like all these, you know, threats to the ADAP. ADAP in California is being re-envisioned as a low-income health plan, which is
ADAP being the
AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which has covered people who have incomes $40,000 and under their HIV medications. And so there's this new plan that is being envisioned, which is going to have a lot of different specifications, and I think it's probably going to end up being a lot worse for people than ADAP. So, you know, on one hand, we are asking questions about that program and about those cuts to ADAP. But on the other hand, we are interested in HIV meds simply not costing as much. It's ridiculous that they cost that much. And as long as they do, there is never going to be a cure. There's never going to be a vaccine, because why would there be when you know drug companies are making between $1,000 to $2,500 a month for people for the rest of their lifetime? They have no investment in changing that scenario. So that is definitely one thing that we're interested in talking about.